crowded hospitals and depressed nurses, where you live and heart attack survival, and a vaccine for breast cancer. Plus, we'll take a look at pediatric poisoning emergencies in this episode. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have a lot coming up, including another segment of Tox Tidbit information from our friend Lisa Booz at the Maryland Poison Center. Lisa will be talking about pediatric poisoning emergencies a little bit later on in this episode after the news. But I wanted to just let you know that was coming up. In the meantime, though, I want to remind all of you, especially all of the brand new listeners here to the show, that you can find a lot of additional information, other articles on nursing, and some great links and resources over at nursingshow.com. Each and every episode has a show notes page. You'll find the link to all the show notes pages at the top of the page. And you can click on that link, find the episode you're looking for, and you'll find links to news items discussed in an episode or additional resource links for the tip of the week or interview segments. All of that's available at nursingshow.com. You can also sign up for the Nursing Show newsletter while you're over there, and that's a great way to get all of those links sent to you by email every single week, plus additional information that we send out occasionally during the course of the month. You'll find all of that in the Nursing Show newsletter. I want to also remind everybody, if you want to get back in touch with me, I love to get email from all of the Nursing Show listeners, so send those emails in. nursingshow@gmail.com is the email address for the show. I respond to every single email I get, so send those emails in asking me questions, making suggestions for future episodes, and yes, definitely, if you have to make any corrections. If I've misspoken, we want to make sure the best possible information gets out to the Nursing Show community, and I do consider this a community effort, so if I've said something wrong, call me on it. Make sure we get the correct information sent out to the listeners. You can also find The Nursing Show over at the Facebook fan page. That is facebook.com/nursingshow. We're really making a push over the course of the next month or so to increase the number of fans over there. You know, we have thousands of listeners here to The Nursing Show, and yet we only have a few hundred fans over at the fan page. So I know a lot of you are on Facebook. Become a fan of The Nursing Show page over there, and that's nursingshow.com, or facebook.com/nursingshow will take you there. So in any case, I want to hear from you, whether it's on the Facebook page, via Twitter response to me over at twitter.com/podmedic, or any other way you might want to get in touch with me. I'd love to hear back from you in any different way that you'd like to use. Time now to jump into this week's news, and let's start off with the initial news item. This caught my eye right away. It's an article I picked up off of 927thevan.com. This is a classic hit radio station. It's an article that they picked up off of the Reuters news service, and it's looking at nurses working in crowded hospitals. Now, this is a European research study, but I think it will apply as well here. Nurses working in crowded hospital conditions have a much higher risk of having depression than their counterparts in less crowded facilities. And you know, it makes sense. People who are overworked are more likely to be depressed. I don't think this is rocket science. But when we're talking about improving patient safety and improving patient outcomes, you know, depressed people just aren't on the top of their game. So anything that can be done to improve the working environment for nurses in these situations will improve patient outcomes. And I think that's what the study here is trying to find out. Now, this is from the May 4th article coming from the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, and it didn't prove that the overcrowding itself contributed to nurses' depression, but it did really look at exactly what the fact that there was a correlation between crowded hospitals and nurse depression. And they thought that chronic stress, heavy workloads, you know, the heavy patient loads that we carry, and especially in high acuity areas, are significant. And we take a lot of that load home with us. The busier we are, the more patients we have to care for. It means that a 12-hour shift may often turn into a 13 or 14-hour shift by the time charting is done. And these types of things really aren't conducive to a person who is relaxed and at ease with what's going on in their life and in their workplace. So I think that this is just an article that points out that there are many different things that can improve the working environment and the safety for patients. I think some organizations out there are really focused in on nurse staffing, and that's important. I think that staffing levels is one aspect of the problem to look at. But I think so often, because those organizations, and these are mainly nurse unions, they mainly focus on the fact of the workplace and the number of nurses that are employed. I mean, heck, that's what they're all about, is finding better nursing employment opportunities and work conditions. But I think there are other things that contribute to the patient safety situation. Yes, nurse staffing is important, but certainly there are other things, including how the patients are brought into the facility, how many patients there are in the facility in general. You know, if you have a small facility that is packed to the gills with patients and staff, people bumping into each other left and right to try to get the same job done is going to cause its own series of issues and headaches. So certainly we need to look at a lot of different aspects. And I think that's interesting that this article looked at a different aspect of what would cause a nurse depression or cause nurses to need a little bit better outlook and focus on different things that they do in the workplace to improve their overall well-being. I mean, okay, we don't take good care of ourselves because we're so busy taking good care of everybody else. And this is just another article that points at some of the things we might need to focus on and do some things to improve our own well-being, psychological well-being included there. The next article I found talks about your location. Where you live improves or decreases your chances of surviving a heart attack? Well, a recent study looked at chances of surviving a heart attack depending on where you live, and this was from a University of Michigan research study. They looked into certain neighborhoods in an area of Georgia and found that, I'm reading some of the things right off the article here, that some of these places where they had incidences of cardiac arrest, that there are two or three times higher rates of cardiac arrest and survival, poorer survival of those cardiac arrests in some neighborhoods than others. And it may have to do with a lot of different things, including the education level of bystanders, the number of bystanders trained to do something as simple as CPR. In residences where patients had a higher risk of heart attack, were more likely to have first responders around, were more likely to have bystanders or people nearby, family members, neighbors, whatever, who had learned CPR. And so it goes to talk about not just environmental factors in the sense of things that might increase your chances of heart attack, but it went to look at survival rates related to community impact and influences. And this certainly looks very carefully at things like cardiac arrest and CPR education in the community. And I'm a big proponent of more CPR education in the community. As a nurse, it's something we may not do CPR very often in the nursing field, unless you're an ER nurse or an ICU nurse or working in a situation where you have high acuity patients. There are a lot of nurses who never do CPR. In my other side of my healthcare persona, as a paramedic, we do CPR all the time. And I know 16-year-olds that have joined the fire company and within 6 months have done CPR on four or five cardiac arrests. Certainly a different outlook on things. But one thing we see in the EMS sector is that many, many patients go 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes before we arrive to begin CPR, when there are family members and other bystanders around. Is it because they didn't know CPR? Is it because they weren't comfortable doing it, even if they knew it? We're not really sure, but certainly this study shows that for areas where people were more likely to have training in CPR, and more likely to have responders close by, those people had better survival rates. Not really a surprise, but certainly an indication that we can do more to educate and get more bystander CPR done and improve outcomes, at least in that way. Finally, the last story I found here is just an exciting story for anybody that's lost a friend or a family member to breast cancer. This is a hot button issue for many, many people. And so the prospect of having some kind of a breast cancer vaccine, similar to what we've now been implementing with the vaccine to ward off genital warts, now we're looking at possibilities of having a vaccine to improve survival or reduce the incidences of breast cancer. This particular article I found was a research study from the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, and there was evidence that there could be a vaccine that would prevent cancers from forming. Remember, cancers are exploded growth of certain cells in the body, and so they just don't get the message to stop reproducing, and they kind of go haywire, and that's where these tumors come from, and they're self-replicating, and they just continue to just not listen to anything else in the body. If there was some way, some vaccine that would tell the body to be more aggressive in shutting those things down, it could be a real boon. And this has been that you know, magic bullet that people have been looking for to deal with cancer. And if there's a way to target specific types of cancer, and this article talks about breast cancer, but the article then goes on to talk about that you could vaccinate against many different types of cancers, potentially based on some recent research done looking into testing a vaccine where they're looking at how this affects cellular growth and reproduction in these abnormal situations. I'm looking forward to more of these things, and these are still things out there in the future, and certainly won't come soon enough for some of our loved ones and even ourselves in some cases. But I'd like to think that this is going to be one of those things that 50 years from now, 30 years from now, maybe even 20 years from now, the cancer will become a thing of the past, much as many other diseases have become prevented and virtually disappeared from our cultural memory in the case of medications coming along to help treat them, like vaccines, or in the case of some serious infections, antibiotics that came along and really changed the outcomes for surgical patients and patients with injuries. If you want to find links to any of these news items, you'll find them over at nursingshow.com. There's a link right at the top of the page in the for the show notes for each episode. And of course, if you're watching this in the video segment, you're already on the Nursing Show site in most cases. So you can just go ahead and look right there at the top of the page. You'll see the word show notes. Click on that, and you can go back and look for all of the links discussed in the news in this episode. I look forward to hearing your comments back. What do you think about some of these things, bystander CPR education? Are you doing enough in your community? Or perhaps nurses in crowded hospital facilities and depression issues? We can really talk about this, and you can leave those comments over at nursingshow.com on the show notes for this episode, or go ahead and shoot me an email. nursingshow@gmail.com. Time now for this week's tip of the week. And this week's tip of the week, we're going to be doing an interview segment with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Lisa has joined us in the past and done a recorded segment. Of course, we started adding video now, but I didn't do any video when we recorded that segment with Lisa earlier. So this will be an audio segment, but I'll throw up some information here to keep your eyes busy if you're watching the video portion of this. Those of you listening along on the regular audio podcast, well, you're used to this anyway. We'll go ahead and get into that segment. Lisa's going to be talking with us about pediatric poisoning emergencies.
Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, with another Tox Tidbits segment with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Lisa, what are we going to be talking about this month?
Well, Jamie, the typical call to a poison center is not what a lot of EMS providers or emergency department staff or hospital physicians and nurses might think of, because they're seeing a lot of the adults that are intentional overdoses or drug abuse cases. But what poison centers hear most about are the little two-year-olds or the three-year-olds who are found with an open bottle of pills or a cleaner. Each year, poison centers in the United States receive more than 2.4 million reports of poisonings and overdoses, and children less than 6 years of age account for more than 50% of those calls. And toddlers less than three are especially at risk for poisonings. That's pretty much the age group that we hear the most about, the two-year-olds and the three-year-olds. Young children are very curious, and if you've ever been around a toddler, you know that they get into everything. As a matter of fact, that's how they learn. They put things in their mouth, and that's their natural way of learning textures and tastes. And it's just natural for them to do that. They often surprise us with their ability to hold things. They can manipulate objects. They can open containers and cabinets. We do use child-resistant containers to try to limit that, but they can get some containers open. And they also climb to reach very high places. Poisonings also occur because products, drugs, and containers sometimes look like food and drinks. And sometimes poisonous products are actually placed in food containers, which really confuses the child, especially when they can't read labels and they don't know the difference. I remember a case that was called into our poison center years ago of a small child who drank from a beverage bottle and had severe burns in the esophagus. It turned out that the bottle contained a caustic industrial cleaner that was brought home from work by a family member. More recently, in one of the toxicology journals, there was a report of a 2.5-year-old who drank from, again, a soda bottle, and it turned out to be an insecticide that was given to the child's mother by a neighbor. And unfortunately, that child, despite noticing the ingestion and that something was wrong and calling 911, the child started seizing and actually died from that exposure. So, unfortunately, people don't think sometimes, and they will put items in food containers, and it confuses kids as well as adults. Fortunately, though, and I just mentioned some serious cases, but fortunately, the majority of poisonings that occur in small children result in few, if any, symptoms because the substances are really not very toxic, or the amounts that the child has ingested are subtoxic. And fatalities are rare. There's an average of 25 deaths in children younger than 6 years of age that are reported by U.S. poison centers each year. There are other kids that die that poison centers don't hear about for one reason or another, but only 25 that are reported on average really every year. It's usually about 25 to 30. Most children don't require any medical care at all. In fact, more than 90% of the childhood poisonings that poison centers are called about are managed at home or at a school or other non-medical location with the advice of a poison specialist. In many of these cases, the poisonous specialist will call back and just make sure that the child is doing okay. If we recommended any therapy, we would make sure that that was done appropriately. Although most of the poisonings are unintentional exposures when the child actually gets access to these products or drugs, we also hear a lot about therapeutic errors. Now, these are situations where maybe the child was given a double dose or given the wrong dose of a drug or the wrong medicine. Maybe the wrong amount was measured out into the oral syringe or a medicine cup. There are a lot of reasons, but these are the most common reasons for therapeutic errors. The substances that are involved in most of the childhood poisonings are products that you commonly find around the home, and these are usually products that are easily accessible to children, products like cleaners and personal care products. Now, most of these products are not very toxic, the exceptions being strong cleaners like oven cleaners and toilet bowl cleaners that are caustic, and some personal care products like perfumes that contain high concentrations of ethanol. But for the most part, personal care products and some of the other household cleaners are not very toxic, and we would handle those cases at home. Young children will sometimes eat leaves and berries from plants in the home and the yard. Fortunately, most of the house plants that we all have growing in our homes in the pots are non-poisonous or they cause very mild symptoms. But when kids go outside and they start picking off berries and leaves of outdoor plants or maybe picking mushrooms out of the yard, that can be a different story because many of those can be quite toxic depending on how much the child ingests it. Medicines are also commonly ingested by small children. The most common medicines that toddlers get into are cough and cold products, vitamins, analgesics, and also antibiotics. These are all medicines that belong to parents or grandparents or that are being given to the child and left out. Most of the substances that children get into are not very toxic, but there are some dangerous products and drugs that can cause very severe toxicity or death, even with very small amounts. Products like caustics that cause esophageal or gastric burns, and hydrocarbons, products like gasoline and lamp oil that can cause a potentially fatal chemical pneumonitis if they're aspirated into the lungs, and it just takes a few drops for that to occur. Antifreeze and windshield washer fluid that you use in your car contain toxic alcohols that can cause multi-organ system toxicity. And camphor is an ingredient that's in some topical products, and that can cause seizures with as little as a mouthful if it's ingested in small children. Medicines that are very toxic, if just one tablet is ingested by a small child, include calcium channel blockers, which will cause bradycardia, hypotension, and heart block, and bupropion, which is an antidepressant that's associated with seizures, even with just one tablet. Also, some medicines for diabetes will cause very severe and prolonged hypoglycemia in small children, and an antihypertensive drug called clonidine can produce very profound hypotension, bradycardia, and respiratory depression. The experts at poison centers are there to help you assess and treat poison patients, but wouldn't it be great if we could all work together to prevent pediatric poisonings from occurring in the first place? So if you want to help prevent poisonings in small children, you can call your local poison center at 1-800-222-1222. Poison centers have education materials and telephone stickers with the poison center phone number on them that can be given to patients and children at schools. Or if you're having a health fair in an open house, you can obtain materials from poison centers and give them out to the people who are attending these events. So again, I encourage you to call the poison center to get these education materials, but also for help in assessing and managing these pediatric poisonings.
And it's important to remember that 800 number is not just for emergency calls. It's not like 911. You can call that just for information.
That's right. That's right. We do get a lot of information calls about drug information questions, drug identification questions. Maybe a parent wants to know how long to keep her child out of the house if the exterminator has come in and sprayed. So we can answer questions. We want to prevent poisonings from occurring. So we will answer questions before a poisoning has occurred, or questions that will hopefully keep poisonings from occurring.
And if something does occur, you also help to prevent that patient from needing healthcare resources outside of the home and taking some of the strain off of the healthcare system when it's possible to do so.
Absolutely. There was a study done many years ago that it was a federal study that showed that every dollar spent on a poison center saves approximately $7 to $10 in healthcare costs. And with time, that savings has probably increased even more than that. So by keeping kids at home, people don't need to call 911. They don't need to rush to the emergency department. And again, we do follow-up calls, so we don't just end the call with that initial call to the poison center in a lot of cases. We will call back and make sure that everything is okay and maybe recommend additional treatment if it's needed at that point.
Great, Lisa. Well, we'll look forward to your next segment. And thanks a lot for taking the time to share with the listeners this great information about how poison centers can help us with not just treating our patients, but preventing injuries to our patients.
You're welcome as always, Jamie.
And I want to thank Lisa again for coming here and getting on the show. I actually call her on the phone to do these interviews, but she's a great resource. And if you want to find out more, contact your local poison center. And again, that poison center number, whether it's for emergencies or non-emergency purposes, is 1-800-222-1222. You can also check in with Lisa directly. Sign up for the email notification of their Tox Tidbit PDF segments. You can get on that email newsletter, whether you're from the state of Maryland or the United States or not. You can get on that by going over to Maryland Poison Center's website at mdpoison.com. And just go ahead and look for the publications link. You can sign up for that email notification. And then when you get notified, head over there and print out those PDF files. They really are great. The Tox Tidbit segments are one-pagers, great for hanging up on a bulletin board in a break room, posting around your facility, or even giving to patients for additional resources. Good information on poisonings going on, and she covers a lot of seasonal things, so you'll be able to
apply what you're getting from her to whatever time of year it is in most of your locations. And you can, again, find more of that from the Maryland Poison Center website at mdpoison.com. And that's going to wrap up this episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank you for checking out the show and remind you again that you can find links to everything discussed in this episode over at nursingshow.com in the show notes area. And just go ahead and check these things out. Follow up on the news items, share the links with other people, and of course, go ahead and follow up on the additional resources for the tip segment this week. Lisa talked about a lot of great things, but there are some links there to the Maryland Poison Center and some other resources on pediatric poisonings. And it's a great way to follow up and get additional information after our brief overview that we cover in this particular show. If you want to get back in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. nursingshow@gmail.com is the email address. Go ahead and shoot me an email with any comments, suggestions, a future episode, links to news items you'd like me to take a look at. Whatever the case may be, I'd love to hear from you. And you can definitely get in touch with me. Again, nursingshow@gmail.com. Or just leave a comment on any of the articles over at the nursingshow.com site. Love to hear back from you either way, and I will be back in touch. I respond to every single email I get, so if you haven't heard from me, it might take me a day or two, but I will get back to you. Also, please keep in touch with me either over on Facebook or over on Twitter. Again, facebook.com/podmedic or twitter.com/podmedic is the way to catch up with me on those social media sites. And we're really still working on that big push to get more fans over at the Nursing Show fan page, facebook.com/nursingshow. Go ahead and become a fan. Suggest it to other people you know. Check in at the Facebook fan page. You can find links there to sign up for the newsletter now. I've put links there to sign up for the podcast, all available at Nursing Show. Facebook.com/nursingshow. So go ahead over there, check it out if you haven't done so already. And if you have become a fan, thank you very much. Go ahead and share some of the postings over there with your Facebook page or suggest them to some of your friends and encourage them to become a fan of The Nursing Show. That's it for me. Let's go ahead and close out the show. Another great link this week to a new song for The Nursing Show. I don't think I've played this song on the show before. This is from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com, and it's a song by the artist by the name of David Homick. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but in any case, there's a link on the site to find his music and his webpage over there. There also will be a button that you can go ahead and click on to pick up the iTunes version of this song. Just click on the button and look around on the iTunes site. You're not going to automatically purchase anything, but it will take you to his page there. And then if you like what you hear, go ahead and buy the song. You know, pick up a song and show your support for these great artists who are supporting podcasts with their great music and giving us the ability to play some good songs here on the show. So this is David Homick with his song, Summer State of Mind. And I'm in a summer state of mind. We're probably, as you're listening to this, I'm on vacation in Florida. So I'm going to be enjoying my summer state of mind. And I hope you are as well. Summer State of Mind with David Homick. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I will be back again next week, every Friday morning, with another episode of The Nursing Show. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Summer will end, but in between we're gonna party. I'm in a state of mind. Well, I'm such a klutz with keeping in touch. It's been 8 months, but every year it's like nothing's ever lost. We pick up where we left off, and we're driving on the highway. There's a barbecue at my place. Break it up at night. Who raised your red cup in the sky? It's the summer state of mind. Always. Whoa, 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 whoa. kids raided the fridge. They pulled out everything and tumbled through soap inside the pool. Well, I got a cup of I don't know what. I'm raising it up in your honor. I got some words to share. I clear my throat, but no one cares. I see the future in the distance. We'll be back again for Christmas. And you'll be smiling so bright like the moon on the beach at night. Who raised your red cup in the sky? It's the summer state of mind. Always. Whoa, whoa. The summer state of mind.